July 31st, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Brother Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
And we are back with another chapter of The Valley of Fear, this chapter 10, or as we like to call it, part 2, chapter 3, Lodge 341, Vermissa.
I would like to make a motion that we begin our discussion.
I second the motion.
Brother Hessenflow. Well, this is certainly a chapter, right? Did you guys enjoy our first glimpse into the workings of the secret society?
Da, da, da.
No.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoy
not
the writing.
Steve.
I enjoy the narrative. I do not enjoy the concept.
Ooh, no, I can see that. So we start out there. This is a kind of time passes chapter, right? So on the day following the evening, which had contained so many exciting events, McMurdo moved his lodgings from old Jacob Shafter's and took up his quarters at the Widow McNamara's on the extreme outskirts of the town. Scanlan, his original acquaintance aboard the train, had occasion shortly afterwards to move into Vermissa, and the two lodged together. There were no other boarders, and the hostess was an easygoing old Irishwoman who left them to themselves, so that they had a freedom for speech and action welcome to men who had secrets in common. So we find out, basically, McMurdo has moved into town. He now has a new living situation. And then we get a whole bunch of details. He still takes his meals at Jacob Shafter's. So even though, didn't that old guy sound like, you're out, buddy? He's like, well, you can still have your meals here. And he's still
But he has the best corned beef in town.
Right? And he still gets to see Eddie, and it sounds like he's still courting Eddie quite passionately.
Mm-hmm. Because of the kindness of Eddie's father? Sorry. Sorry.
It's an odd detail. And then he shows some of the guys his counterfeit plates, and he gives them counterfeit money, which they can pass no problem. He does keep working as a bookkeeper, despite the fact that he seems to be pretty flush with all his counterfeit money. Now, interestingly, he has this altercation with the mine police. Mm. And I thought this was interesting just because between the sections of this novel, we get a lot of different types of detection, right? Mm-hmm. Inspector Mac, the young guy, White Mason, the older constable, Watson and Holmes, the consultings, and now we see those cops on the train who McMurdo treats very badly. So now we meet the mine police. This was a special body raised by the railways and colliery owners to supplement the efforts of the ordinary civil police, who were perfectly helpless in the face of the organized ruffianism which terrorized the district.
Sound like enforcers to me.
Mm-hmm. The business of the mine being protected by these law enforcement characters. Hmm.
And these guys are Pinkertons, right? So in general, so that was at this time in the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s. This is some of the work that Pinkerton detectives do. You can hire them to solve your mysteries, but that's not most of their work. Most of their work is actually working for big corporations, protecting their assets, and then also providing surveillance for your employees. So say you were a banker and you were like, ooh, I want to make sure that all of my clerks are, you know, good, morally upstanding young men. You would hire the Pinkertons to follow them around and make sure they're upstanding. Hmm. So this is the kind of private detective force that you have in the U.S. that you do not have in Britain at this time.
Wow. Boy, that doesn't lead to any problems down the line historically. So it's fine. You can hire your own muscle to face the organized ruffianism.
Well, ooh. Even think about it today, though, Steve. You're going to be hired by a school district or employer. Many times you have to get your fingerprints done. They do a background check. Mm-hmm. They're doing all this stuff anyway. This is a version of that. I'm not saying that having a group of muscle as an enforcer, but the idea of an employer checking their employees, I mean, it just seems like it's been going on. It still goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And then as time passes and McMurdo gets settled into the community, we have this moment where a Chicago police detective arrives into town and he recognizes McMurdo. And here's the quote. Marvin, the Chicago cop, left the barroom, but not before he had created a local hero. McMurdo's deeds in far Chicago had been whispered before. He had put off all questions with a smile as one who did not wish to have greatness thrust upon him. But now the thing was officially confirmed. The bar loafers crowded round him and shook him heartily by the hand. Because this Chicago cop is like, I recognize you and I know why you left Chicago. Seems like he's out of jurisdiction. He doesn't arrest him, I guess, but confirms that this is a bad guy.
Hmm. So I immediately knew there was something up because I know that there's not a Marvin who was a police officer. I only know Marvin the Martian.
Oh, you're a P-42 explosive modulator. Good, Chip. You are paying good attention.
Oh, I take that back.
Too late.
Too late, indeed. No, I feel like that segues beautifully into the initiation ceremony, which is rather dark. Thanks for that. What did you guys think of this initiation ceremony?
Well, it was a call and response. We had some things that they had to do. If you've read anything about secret societies or seen Eyes Wide Shut, you see some kind of ceremony going on. Mm-hmm. And this seems like it fits right into what a ceremony could be.
I was going to say Revenge of the Nerds, but okay, you went to Eyes Wide Shut instead. But yes, we have all sorts of secret societies and secret fraternities that have all sorts of ceremonies, and this seems to fill that void right there.
Yes, and it's described, I think, really nicely. You get like a real sense of the place. Mm-hmm. The setting is the first thing we learn. In the bare assembly room, the men were gathered around a long table. At the side was a second one laden with bottles and glasses on which some members of the company were already turning their eyes. McGinty sat at the head with a flat black velvet cap upon his shock of tangled black hair and a colored purple stole round his neck so that he seemed to be a priest presiding over some diabolical ritual. To right and left of him were the higher lodge officials, the cruel, handsome face of Ted Baldwin among them. Each of these wore some scarf or medallion as emblem of his office. So there's a certain pomp and circumstance here mm-hmm. that reminds you of, diabolical rituals mm-hmm. of various kinds.
Kevin Bacon. Thank you, sir. May I have another? Sorry. That's Animal House.
Now, I thought it was interesting that there are the older guys with their tigerish, lawless souls. But then there's a whole bunch of young guys here, right? And the narrator says it was difficult to believe that these eager and open-faced young fellows were in very truth a dangerous gang of murderers whose minds had suffered such complete moral perversion that they took a horrible pride in their proficiency at the business and looked with deepest respect at the man who had the reputation of making what they called a clean job. So there's this notion of like really young guys from the community being recruited into this order that's pretty terrifying.
Mm-hmm. And so well written here. You really get a sense of this scene and you have your feelings about whether this is something that you have been a part of before or not. And you get the message from Doyle about how he feels about this. These words, horrible pride and lawless souls. It's pretty obvious how Doyle feels about this.
A little value judgment here and there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the preparation. So the bodymaster orders that he shall be trussed, blinded, and entered, said he. The three of them removed his coat. This is McMurdo. Turned up the sleeve of his right arm and finally passed a rope round above the elbows and made it fast. They next placed a thick black cap right over his head and the upper part of his face so that he could see nothing. He was then led into the assembly hall. So this notion, the initiation ritual of putting your faith into these guys, entering the room blind, mm-hmm. not sure what's going to happen. And then, of course, there is the test. And, oh, the first part of the test where there was something against his eyes and he had to move forward.
Right. He said, walk forward. And he's like, ah, I could feel something that's about to poke my eyes out. And I'll walk forward anyway. And that's the test. They will move whatever it was so that he doesn't poke his eyes out. Ugh.
That's not for me.
anything about eyes. Anything about eyes, I'm out.
Have you ever read, like, the Mason rituals, at least the first levels or so, they're readily available. You can just look them up.
No, thank you.
I'm with Steve on this.
Well, they're fascinating. I mean, the things they talk about are horrific. I mean, they're very similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you talk of this, we'll cut your tongue out, things of that nature. Or you agree to have that done. So these are just, they're part of the ceremonies they end up running.
Mm-hmm.
And then the test, which I'll read. He is of stout heart, said the voice. Can you bear pain as well as another? He answered. Test him. It was all he could do to keep himself from screaming out, for an agonizing pain shot through his forearm. He nearly fainted at the sudden shock of it, but he bit his lip and clenched his hands to hide his agony. I can take more than that, said he. This time there was loud applause. A finer first appearance had never been made in the lodge. So this is where he gets branded.
Mm.
And he's like, I could take more.
Yeah, he's showing his toughness in a way that most people hadn't before. It's revealed that most people had at least shouted out when they branded them, and he was able to bite his tongue, literally, and not shout out during this awful pain.
So once the initiation is over, we move to the agenda. Wasn't that great? I love that.
Who's making potato salad?
There's motions and all kinds of things. So motion number one is that we need a couple guys to perform a murder for a nearby lodge because they did one for us. So we are returning the favor. Who's in? The men are chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that he sets this up so that we see all the different kinds of activities, right, of the Scourers. Mm-hmm. Motion two is dealing with foreman Blaker. McMurdo rose to his feet for an instant. I would say, eminent bodymaster, that if a man should be wanted, I should take it as an honor to be chosen to help the lodge. There was great applause at this. It was felt that a new sun was pushing its rim above the horizon. To some of the elders, it seemed that the progress was a little too rapid.
Mm-hmm.
I would move, said the Secretary Haraway, a vulture-faced old graybeard who sat near the chairman, that Brother McMurdo should wait until it is the good pleasure of the lodge to employ him. So he volunteers to do this dangerous task, and some of the old guys are like, we don't like this young guy who just was branded 2 seconds ago taking on these big tasks.
Mm-hmm. This is certainly, like it says, a new sun pushing above the horizon.
Right?
He is the superstar. It's a great image. He is looked at by all of these people as something important, and he volunteers to be a part of this whole thing, and the old people are like, wait a minute, he just walked into town a very short amount of time ago. We don't actually know we can trust him yet.
And then motion number three is making sure we get a pension to Jim Carnaway's widow.
It is. I think that is probably one of the most interesting. Obviously, the underground movement that they have certainly is questionable, but this is part of having why people joined these types of organizations initially. And that was that if something would happen to the father, to the breadwinner of the family, certainly their whole family could suffer, and they could suffer big time. And so it looks like that there is Jim Carnaway is a widow, is going to receive a payment. The treasurer basically looks at the bank balance and says, we can continue to make this. And it just shows a little bit of how fraternal societies and mutual aid societies initially were set up. So I found the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, and I just looked up on their website. And it says, by the 1890s, however, when millions of new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe began arriving to the United States, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment and racist attitudes created a bias against allowing new immigrants and African Americans from joining older societies, preventing from growing established societies like Freemasons or the Knights of Pythias. New immigrants and blacks had to form their own. And so we have what will be, I mean, it looks like it's an Irish order, but it's basically being established here in the United States. And ultimately, the one function they provide is to take care of each other's families in case something would happen to them. And I should point out that if we look at mutual insurance companies, even as they exist today, many of them have basis in some kind of fraternal society. And a mutual insurance company is an insurance company that's owned by its policyholders. And so all the members of this society or this group, you know, they basically are insuring themselves because statistically something will happen to one of its members. And the last thing I want to kind of point out is that they're having an anti-secret society movement is not particularly unknown in this time. The United States, up until 1888, they had two parties that were anti-Masons, and they were opponents of Freemasonry. So this is not a Freemason society. But it should be noted that there is certainly a distrust of secret societies going on in society during this time. And I think Doyle is picking up on this too.
And putting it out there so well for us. My question is this a message about an exotic place in America, or is this a message to some of these societies and mutual aid organizations in the UK? And what's Doyle saying here? He seems to be very much against this idea. He seems to be telling us that these are murder groups. And boy.
Well, you have to realize that the Industrial Revolution is going on. There's a lot of movement. Society is changing dramatically. You know, you move from this incredible poverty in the, maybe from the farm area to a city, and you're living in squalor there too. I mean, for the poor people, they still are looking for opportunities to work themselves up. I mean, think a little bit about the employees that are working in many of the Chinese companies out there, or maybe even third world companies. What are they looking? They're looking for a better life, but to move to that area certainly is a leap of chance. I mean, mm-hmm. you're basically taking a risk to move there, and your hope is that it's a better life than what you left. And if something would happen to you, your family members really could be at this time just thrown on the streets, and that's a pretty scary situation. And so and to look at this in another truly negative light, if you remember earlier, was it last year, The Best of Enemies came in? That was the movie about the guy who was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan in Durham, who mm-hmm. befriended the activist, Durham, North Carolina, who befriended the activist, and they became best friends, and he left the Ku Klux Klan because of her. He owned a gas station. He was just trying to make ends meet. He was just trying to get by, and he didn't realize he was being used at that time. But I have a feeling that many people, particularly negative situations in these types of organizations, are just looking for some potential of getting into a connected group, feeling part of something, and just trying to better their personal situation, maybe not realizing it could impact others negatively.
And one of the questions for us to think about as we read this book is that representation? Like, are all the people in this society being portrayed as murderers and ruffians? Or is there this sense of like a systemic issue where people are being kind of recruited into this society and not really committed to its goals? And so the next item on the agenda is actually a sort of existential question about the protection business. So there's a note that some of the small business owners are just leaving the area because they don't want to pay protections to the scourers. And so there's this moment I think is really interesting. It is my advice, the speaker continued, this is Brother Morris, that we go easier upon the small men. On the day that they have all been driven out, the power of the society will have been broken. Unwelcome truths are not popular. There were angry cries as the speaker resumed his seat. McGinty rose with gloom upon his brow. Brother Morris, said he, you were always a croaker. So long as the members of this lodge stand together, there is no power in the United States that can touch them. And then Brother Morris backs down, but he's not necessarily wrong. Mm-hmm. Right? He's saying, like, look, if the small guys leave, these big companies come in, possibly bringing their own mine police, mm-hmm. like, we're going to lose a big revenue stream.
And in fact, that during the same conversation, they were calling out, like, all right, so, you know, whatever the guy is, John sold his farm or his business. Who bought it? And they were naming who was bet. It was two companies. They were mm-hmm. buying the rice right. there. One was like a railroad and one was a mining company. So mm-hmm. it was already showing that's exactly what was happening, is that they were creating a situation that I've got to leave. I've got to leave quickly. Who's going to buy? Who's going to put together the money? And it was these big companies. And it was undermining their lodge's business.
Exactly. So it's unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And then the final item on the agenda is James Stanger of the Vermissa Herald. He has been writing unflattering articles about the Scourers. So maybe he should be dealt with. Now, I really like this description of Brother Morris. Check this out. I protest against that, said Brother Morris, the man of the good brow and shaved face. I tell you, brethren, that our hand is too heavy in this valley, and that there will come a point where in self-defense, every man will unite to crush us out. James Stanger is an old man. He is respected in the township and the district. His paper stands for all that is solid in the valley. If that man is struck down, there will be a stir through this state that will only end with our destruction. And here's where McGinty is like, I got my eye on you. However, he decides that Stanger should get a warning rather than a death sentence, possibly as a result of Brother Morris's note. Now, Brother Morris is the man of the good brow and the shaved face. What is that telling us about beards?
Bad guys. Bad guys have facial hair. We learned that right? in Star Trek.
I'm going to say the power of the press. They're right there.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. There's certainly... The voice of the press, if you try to shut down the press will work together just as well as this society will.
And we also recognize that Philadelphia and the Northeast at that time was a very educated. This is a unique, the American experiment certainly is very unique. The people who came over were educated. So as we're moving out this new group of immigrants, they may not be as highly educated. But you know what? You start showing off some violence or something of that nature, you could easily see where the Philadelphia Inquirer, whatever the version of it at that time, could take notice. And all of a sudden, there could be more people in the area, more people checking in and seeing what's really mm-hmm. going on and undercover or undermine their ability to continue their bad ways.
Hmm.
Which brings us to McMurdo's first action as now officially a Scourer with his brand still hot upon him. So a bunch of the guys go out to the Vermissa Herald and they attack the old man. And it's really sad, like the description. And again, as a person who's like practically blind, his glasses fall to the ground as he's being beaten. And that little detail really speaks to me of like just how vulnerable you feel without your glasses. And so McMurdo actually conflicts with Baldwin here, and he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Bodymaster McGinty said, don't kill this guy. We're just supposed to rough him up. So pause. So that brings us to the very ending of this chapter. There was indeed the sound of shouting in the street, and a little group of compositors and pressmen was forming in the hall below and nerving itself to action. Leaving the limp and motionless body of the editor at the head of the stair, the criminals rushed down and made their way swiftly across the street. Having reached the Union House, some of them mixed with the crowd in McGinty's saloon, whispering across the bar to the boss that the job had been well carried through. Others, and among them McMurdo, broke away into side streets and so by devious paths to their own homes. End of chapter. So we get rather a lot happening in this chapter as McMurdo actually becomes an official member of the secret society and actually participates in the very first crime that, well, he starts out with his counterfeit money, but he participates in the first violent crime that he's going to participate in.
Hmm. Well, I'm putting down my first counterfeit dollar. I think I figured it out.
I think that this is chapter 3 of a tale, and boy is Doyle good at putting down the darkness in chapter 3 to lead us toward the light in the subsequent chapters, I hope, because boy was this dark.
This is a pretty dark one.
Violence. There's a lot of violence inherent in the system. Mm-hmm. Help, help, I'm being repressed. Sorry.
And I'm kind of intrigued by the sort of bureaucracy of that violence, too.
Well, it's organized. This is organized crime.
This is, mm-hmm. by definition, this is organized crime. Coming from Chicago, McMurdo knows organized crime, and here it is, very organized.
Yeah, see here. It's organized crime. Yeah.
Yeah, you killed my brother. All right, so I can talk now because I'm done talking about violence and all of the bad things, and we can get back to the fun. Remember the fun? Doesn't anybody remember the laughs that we had in the first part of this book?
Is it possible that you do not understand the importance of the missing dumbbell, dear Watson?
There, right. There.
A long time ago, friend.
Where's my umbrella, Holmes? You left my umbrella. I want my umbrella back. That's what I want.
Well, next chapter sets us up because we learn what is the Valley of Fear.
Excellent. That I'm sure that won't be dark at all. That sounds foreboding. Just the way you say it sounds just dark. All right. So I hope everyone is still with us. I hope everyone is enjoying this as much as you possibly can with all the violence and all of the terrible description. It's great description. The narrative description is great. Fine. It's great. Fine. Join us tomorrow as we talk about Chapter 11, The Valley of Fear. We would love to hear from you. Send us an email. Send us a voicemail. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, for all of these conversations. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Brother Chip Essendorf.
And I'm Pam Bedard.